Welcome to Be Simply. This is She, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have special guest Wuda in from Taiwan. He was here in the Los Angeles area this spring, and now we're moving into summer in the northern hemisphere of the planet. In our discourse, this will be a two-part discourse. You can listen in again next week. We will share some tea, and Wuda will share some Zen teachings, talk about cultivating bodhicitta, and share where they're at with the Tea Center in Taiwan. Without further ado, let's dive in with Wuda. Again, with Wuda, which is such a pleasure in Venice Beach, having some beautiful tea. What tea are we drinking, Wuda?
A wild red tea from central Taiwan, from old growth trees.
Yummy.
Completely wild.
Completely wild. It's good for me. Wild.
Wow. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's good to see you. So, I wanted to ask you yesterday or the day before when we saw each other, you were talking about dolphins and peacocks, and I really appreciated that discourse because I think right now sometimes for those of us that are in our practice, sometimes it's hard to navigate not being with the dolphins and the peacocks, but it's so necessary to be outside of that mystical, perfect, perceived garden.
Yes. Well, dolphins and peacocks are just like a facetious, funny kind of clown shaman way that we use that at our center to, should we wait for that?
It's okay.
Okay.
Keeps it real.
Keeps it real. Well, it's a way at our center that we talk about how sometimes spiritual practice can be escapism and how to avoid making your practice into escapism. And, you know, every person who's ever practiced spiritually has faced that challenge, including us, including our center, which is obviously why the discussions and the joke of peacocks and feathers came up, because it came up in discussion of our practice, not in discussion of pointing fingers at other people. But the idea is that you build a really beautiful ashram with peacocks and dolphins, and then what can happen, there's a sense where there's kind of a wall between you and the world, and ashram kind of becomes like a stage on which we all play roles of spiritual people, and what that, you know, whatever that means, whatever that looks like. And then, you know, somebody negative comes, somebody really sick, somebody that really needs, you know, love, and we want to push them out because they're spoiling our scene, they're spoiling the show. And just because you have a wall, and inside that wall is a beautiful garden full of peacocks and dolphins, doesn't mean you're any less connected to gangsters in Los Angeles or war or negativity in the world. So you can't hide. You can't hide in the sense that you can't disconnect from the karmic web of the whole universe. You can't hide anything. Nothing you do, even behind walls, nothing you do is hidden. And I don't necessarily mean that unseen beings are watching, though I'm open to that possibility. What I'm more saying is that when you do actions, even behind closed doors, when you feel you're in so-called privacy, your actions are still connected to the web. So you're not hidden, you're not like in some extra-dimensional closet in which you can perform deeds, and those deeds don't have consequences.
Right.
Right? This is a topic that comes up a lot in Buddhism with regards also to sexual misconduct, is that even if both people are adults and they're consenting, it is delusory, it is wrong for you to think that there isn't causal chains that are unlocked by that act, or that it's somehow free. It's
right.
Never free. There's always cause in every action, not just sexual acts, but in every action there's connection. So we're always connected. And it's wonderful to build a beautiful garden with peacocks and dolphins as a celebration of beauty and life and just, you know, of gardens even. And that inspires people to come, and they're attracted to that beauty. So what we're talking about isn't a rejection of beauty. Trying to isolate yourself from all negativity rather than working with it. Because the internal version of the peacocks and dolphins is that you start repressing. Right? Mm-hmm. I didn't get into spiritual work to avoid negativity, to escape it. I didn't get into spiritual work to rest in a delusory positivity that's based on ignorance. My practice is to develop the strength and tools to overcome my negativities, to bring them up in the light of day, mm. and face them with a warrior spirit and overcome them. Mm. So not to hide from them or pretend they're not real or push them away, because the ones in the world who are easy to love, they've got plenty of love. Mm-hmm. It's the ones that are challenging to love that we have to love, and that's how we exercise our heart, which is a muscle that needs exercise. We have to exercise it by loving the ones that are more challenging to love. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are more challenging to love are, in 99.9% of the cases, they are who they are because they weren't loved enough. Mm-hmm. And so you're just continuing that pattern of that, you know. So it's not to say every ashram with a garden with peacocks and dolphins is guilty of this. It's to say that we're all can be guilty of it, internally and externally. Of, you know, our center is also very beautiful, just for the record. There are no peacocks and dolphins, but there's a lot of beautiful things there. And you know, it's easy to go into that beauty in a sense of escaping. Mm. But I guess the key point is to remember always the tagline, always the tagline for everything that is personal work. The tagline always at the end is what? For the good of all beings. Mm. I go into this meditation retreat for the good of all beings. So the end result is in service.
Right.
So service is the end game. And so even if we do isolate ourselves from negativity, in order to have the space to cultivate ourselves, the end goal is so that we can go out and, you know, externally do work. But also the end goal is so that internally we can not live in an internal garden of peacocks and dolphins, but actually face our problems, actually stand, you know, work with them and transcend them and overcome them rather than repressing them or ignoring them or deluding ourselves.
Right.
You know, which can make practice into almost like a drug or something, in the sense that you're, you know, getting high on positivity to escape your own work that you have to do.
Hmm. So you bring up a great point when you're speaking. You're reminding me of a positive charge and a negative charge, meaning that both energy fields exist. Just in science, we understand their relationship potentially, if you've studied how a battery operates. If you can share a little bit in that practice, even within integrating the tea, how the tea is such a beautiful, as you talked about, this clean energy in the sense that it kind of lifts you up, yet it still asks you to face some things that are internal. If you can share a little bit about the possibility, how you can work within the practice of tea to embrace both aspects of self, and then that way maybe be more of service to another that you can have compassion for, because maybe they're walking down a path that you've already walked down.
Yeah, well, I mean, one way that we do this that has been around for a really long time is there the oldest extant book on tea. It's called the Cha Ching. It's not the most likely not the oldest book. It's still the oldest one surviving. But anyway, it's celebrated as the first book on tea. By a guy named Lu Yu, and in there he kind of suggests something that in our tradition we try to uphold, which is to never decline an invitation to tea. The man of tea never declines an invitation to tea. Because if you're invited to tea, even with your enemy, like, that's one of two things, which one is that what a beautiful chance to make peace. And if not peace, then what a beautiful chance to understand your enemy. And so in practicing that and navigating that, I guess, you know, for us it means like we go out and serve a lot of roadside tea, where we set up and there's no agenda or teaching, there's just tea, and there's passersby, and they can sit for one bowl, and we cultivate a space of presence and loving kindness, and we maintain that energy field. And then what they want to do with that space is up to them. They can chat about the tea on a kind of linear level, or they can sit in silence, or they can ask questions, life questions, wisdom questions, or they can just, you know, chat about any matter. And that practice means essentially what tea's about is just holding space and allowing anybody to come, and you're just there to serve. Just, and you know, it's kind of like they can work it out. They'll use the tea for whatever they want to use it for, and I'm not here to choose them. And in a way, this is a practice also for me. This is an ancient practice, you know, in India, for example. Just about all the ashrams serve food to the poor. And outside, you can think that this is about helping the poor. In a sense, it is, because, you know, that's a good thing. But you feed a poor guy, he's hungry again tomorrow. The Buddha spoke about this. You feed the poor guy, he's hungry again tomorrow. You give him clothes, he needs new clothes again a year later. So it's the spiritual gifts that are the ones that really transform the consciousness and evolve the life on this planet. And so you can see that the real gift, the real transformation, is less in the poor people who are coming there to eat every day, and more in the ones that are coming there to volunteer and cook that food and serve. At the end of a year, the homeless guy that comes 17 times for food at the soup kitchen is going to most likely be less transformed by that food than the one who shows up there 17 times to serve food to homeless people all day long. I mean, there's all the exceptions in that. You see, but you see the real transformations in that service and connection, and that's one practice, is that you know, you don't be willing to serve tea wherever and to whomever, and practice that kind of the open invitation. The practicalities of that can be challenging when you're a person of tea. A person of tea we call chajin. So it can be challenging when you're a chajin because you can't turn down an invitation for tea. So one practical way you can deal with that we've found is that you know, if somebody calls and invites you for tea, and the practicality is that you can't come on that day because you have some event, don't disengage until you've postponed it. Then you technically haven't said no. So you call me and you're like, can you come over for tea on Tuesday at 2? And I can't because I have a serious event at that point. I can say to you right on the phone right then, I can't come on Tuesday. How about Wednesday? And you say, no. And I say, how about Thursday? Okay, but we set some date. So we're still having tea. I haven't turned on your invitation. I've just changed the time. So that's one way to practice that. But take it seriously if you're a person of tea, you take it seriously when someone invites you to tea. You know, and you don't assume that it's something casual. It's a good chance for you to show up, right? And just that act, just the practice. Doesn't matter what the tea session will be, just the practice of, like, you know, when I hear the word tea, I show up. Kind of helps to work with some of that kind of aspect of taking tea out and just sharing it with people. It's a big part of how you learn about tea too. It's like serving it to people. The more you serve tea, the better. Especially in our tradition, because as we always say, the slogan is, we're not here to learn how to make tea, we're here to learn how to serve tea. So it's all about service. This is a tradition of service. And you don't have to be anything or believe anything or practice any certain way to be able to share tea with me or with any, or technically with anyone. You know. So that's what makes tea suitable for this. It's not about, you know, may the good people come drink tea with us and the negative ones not. In thousands and thousands of tea sessions all around the world, believe me, I've had my share of people who didn't understand the context or weren't interested, or, you know, there's not any. But see, my aim is not to create a scene. So my aim is not to create a theater and then and then on that stage perform a show. Yeah. And that show is, you know, we the spiritual people. This is what we look like. Yeah. That's antithetical to Zen anyway. Yeah. So a lot of people have a common kind of understanding that spirituality, or a spiritual person, a holy person, whatever that looks like, a holy person is defined thus. And they draw the outline of that person. Or maybe it's a spiritual Buddha looks like thus. Mm. Like, that's what I want to be. That's my goal. That's my golden Buddha, right? Mm. And then they try to take themselves and conform themselves to that shape. But the thing is, even if you get in that shape, it's kind of like that movie Nutty Professor, where like it starts coming out during the day, like his cheek is like broop, and then he like shoves it back in, and then his stomach comes out like broop, and then he kind of, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the Zen perspective is to take that kind of holiness and sprinkle it like snow over this, over this Buddha, over everything, over all the so-called dirt, right? Yeah. All the and there's a lot of Zen stories that kind of highlight that that truth of kind of trying to you know, that it's about this, that these dialectics are in your head, that the separations are conceptual. There's a famous tea one too. Rikyo's son, he asked him to clean the roji, which is the path to the tea room. And he cleans, and am I done, father? No. And so then he like picks out every stray weed. Am I done, father? No. So then he like trims all the flowers. Am I done, father? No. So he trims all the bushes, everything perfect. He even sprinkles some water on everything. Am I done, father? And Rikyo says, sigh. Well, the guests are going to be here really soon, and you haven't figured it out. So let me show you how to clean the garden. And he comes over to the autumn maple tree and shakes it and knocks all the leaves all over the garden.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And that kind of expresses that a little bit, and the truth that that all of this is holy, that all of it is, that all of it is sacred, that it's all perfect. That there is a sense in which we can't move forward from a space of idealism, because when we concretize the ideals, we fight each other.
Mm.
So ideals are unaccepting of what actually is.
Mm.
When you say the world should be X, the world that you've created in your head isn't complete. It doesn't include atoms and subatomic particles and molds and funguses. It's a very limited stage. In other words, you've created a Hollywood set with peacocks and dolphins. And everybody's happy and singing around because it's a Mary Poppins set.
Right.
And on a Mary Poppins set, we don't want a drunk, angry dude. When a drunk, angry dude comes onto the Mary Poppins...
That might be Mary Poppins.
When a drunk, angry dude comes onto the Mary Poppins set, what happens? They call security.
Mm.
And he's thrown out of the building.
Right.
Yeah? But in the real world, you can't throw him out of the world.
Right.
Where are you going to throw him? Right. You know, there's no... I mean, we can put him in a black hole. He'll just pop out in some other world.
Yeah.
So that doesn't... We can't do that. So I'm not saying we shouldn't all be enthusiastic about creating a world in which there's no rape or murder or negativity. I'm very enthusiastic towards creating such a world. And I'm also very accepting and loving of this world as it is, because that's the real starting place. We can't get to a world free of negativity if we don't start from an understanding of this world as it is. Because if I don't have an understanding and acceptance of this world as it is, I will be constitutionally incapable of helping anyone get anywhere, because I'll just become that which I'm trying to heal. In other words, I'll start getting angry at angry people.
Mm.
And then wink, 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 and tap your shoes 3 times, and I'm an angry person.
Right.
You know?
Mm. So you're creating a bridge. If you can share what you stated is so beautiful. Just a simple act of how someone can authentically be honest with themselves in the process. I oftentimes will remind people, you can run ahead if you like, but more than likely you'll be asked to come back, like the Candyland game where you have to go back to the starting if you've got all the way to the final piece of candy on the board. If you can just share in your own experience how to authentically show up for yourself in every moment so that you can continue to understand self and at the same time be of service to others that are wherever they are, whether they're in their darkest state or their lightest state, but holding them with a loving and compassionate heart.
Well, for me as a teacher, it's all about architecting the system to include the end of the system. It's about, you know, in plain terms, one of the first lessons I received after transmission from my master was that when every student comes to you, the first thing you do is show them your humanity. Mm-hmm. If they want a golden Buddha, go buy one.
Mm-hmm.
They're for sale, right? But that's just it. See, these are the Zen stories I was talking about. You know, there's a one that I love a lot, which is the holy man Li was so immaculate that the villagers traveled for miles to bring him offerings of food. And even the animals, the deers and the bird, came to his cave and laid food and offerings. But then one day the holy man Li achieved enlightenment, and no villagers came to his cave, and no more animals came to offer him anything. He had to walk down and beg like the rest of them. So another version of this is that there's a monk ardently meditating on the rock, and his master walks by him and then comes back the next day. He's still very seriously sitting on that rock, and the master sits down in front of him and starts polishing one of the bricks on the cobblestone path. After a few hours, the student can't take it anymore, and he says, "What are you doing?" The master says, "Well, I'm going to polish this stone until it's a mirror." And the student says, "You could polish that brick for 1,000,000 years, it will never be a mirror." And the master says, "You can polish that ego for 1,000,000 years, and it will never be a Buddha." So, as a teacher, it's about, you know, in Zen, the Zen kind of architecture is that the student comes, and then the kind of agenda is kill the Buddha, kill the parents, kill the teacher. And each of these, the words are strong, but kill the Buddha means kill the idea that something outside of you is going to liberate you. Kill the idea that it's outside at all, because it's inside of you, right? If you see your eyes, then you have cataracts. If you hear your ears, you have tinnitus. If you see the camera lens when you take a picture of me, your camera lens is broken, right? So that you see the Buddha outside means the Buddha inside is broken. Because if the Buddha inside is activated, everything is Buddha, and then therefore also nothing's Buddha. If the whole world were blue, there's no such thing as blue. All is blue. So that's the first one. The second, kill of the parents means show me you outside of all the conditioning, your true self. Outside of all the attachments, outside of all the conditioning, outside of all of your learned experience, right? Outside of all your prejudices and opinions and accumulated habit patterns. And then the third one is kill the teacher. Kill this system of killing things. Kill this whole game.
Right.
Kill the whole game.
And then we can be in with dolphins and peacocks all together.
Yes. And so, for me, that's how when the teacher's architecting that into the system, that's how things stay clean between teachers and students. For me personally, this is just my personal thing. None of my teachers did this. So this is just about me. I try to also cultivate deep friendship and bonds of like brother sisterhood with my students, so that when that time comes to kill the teacher and that role is dead, we still have something. Because I didn't have that with my teacher. So when that role was ended, there was nothing left. Our time together was completely done. But maybe I'm just a little bit more human. I'm a little bit more attached. Maybe I'd like to be friends after that. And just hang out and have tea.
Yeah.
So, that's a big part of how I incorporate that kind of teaching into the teacher-student relationship.
Mm.
Into keeping it real. You know, making it real.
Mm.
And not allowing any of the drama that can come with that relationship.
Right.
Which that relationship has been abused so much that some people are just frightened of it in general, unfortunately.
Okay.
Which is sad because it's so important, right? I could sit on an island and I could brew tea from like 6 a.m. until midnight for 100 years,
mm-hmm.
and I would never figure out even 15% of what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I know has been handed down to me from a lineage of hundreds of years and hundreds of lifetimes.
Right.
And you can't, you know, it's kind of like any human being without a learning disability can learn algebra in 2 years with a teacher and a book.
Mm-hmm.
100% of people that don't have a learning disability can learn algebra in 2 years with a teacher and a book. That percentage is probably halved if you take away the teacher and only have the book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe only 30-50% of human beings on this earth could learn algebra in 2 years with just a book and no teacher.
Mm-hmm.
0% of human beings could learn algebra in 2 years without a book or a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody on the island all of a sudden learns algebra. Because algebra is accumulated power.
Right.
So is your cell phone. It's thousands of years. This microphone, this technology is thousands of years of accumulated power. So are we. Our DNA, our language. Right. So there's a very real truth to accumulated power and lineage.
Mm.
And the necessity for that. And the need for that kind of transmission.
Mm.
You know, to happen. That it's abused is sad, because then you have teachers who are serving self rather than serving their students.
Mm.
The teacher's role is the role of a servant.
Mm.
Right? Not the role of a taker,
right.
But the role of a giver.
Mm.
Even the if there is embedded in that relationship the opportunity for the student to pay respect, that still is a service, because sometimes the greatest gift of all is the opportunity to give.
Mm.
But it becomes sticky.
Mm.
And results in all of that. So, and it's not about building a beautiful center or peacocks and dolphins. It's about the being aware of, you know, first of all, taking for granted that you live in a beautiful place, that your body's comfortable, that you don't face physical violence.
Mm.
The inventors of martial arts were Buddhist monks. They are the inventors of martial arts in this world. And the reason is because, you know, they inhabited a world full of bandits and thieves and crazies. And these crazies didn't care if you were a monk. So just to travel the three mountains over, the 5 kilometers over to see their master in their cave and receive their next meditation technique, they had to pass through a bunch of valleys full of crazies and bandits. and maybe defend others as well. Because maybe what they might stumble upon, rather than a bandit who wants to rob them, they might stumble on a bandit who's robbing a family. So, you know, we live in a world where we don't face that, and where we have good food and, you know, ability to practice. And you can make that into a stage. And you can see how this is happening on a global level right now.
Right.
So environmentally, there's a lot of places in America that are cleaning up.
Right.
But a big part of that is because it's all been moved over to China. And a lot of people want to point their finger and say, oh, those Chinese, they're so dirty and polluted.
Right.
But they're dirty and polluted making goods for America.
Right.
And this is the globe. So moving pollution over there is like sweeping the dirt under your rug.
We all live downhill. We're on a ball.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's not, you know, you're just moving the dirt from one part of your house to the other.
Right.
And you can't, you know, that's what you're doing if you create an ashram that excludes people. Or that, you know, a better perspective is the perspective, another analogy that I always use is that we are not, you know, my tradition, our tea family, we are not, we are like a department in the company Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And while we have to focus on the responsibilities of our department, our overall aim is the success of the company.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I don't want our organization to just improve the lives of the people within our organization.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to make a difference anywhere there's an edge.
For the benefit of all beings.
For the benefit of all beings. So anywhere our tradition meets anybody, we try to
mm-hmm.
serve those people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about you know, teaching and instructing people how to serve tea. In other words, how to take tea out and serve it. And so there's something for everyone. So it's kind of like we show up and we have this like meal that we prepare every time. And there's like 7 dishes. And if somebody wants to come and just have a tomato, just one part of one dish, not even try one of the 7 dishes. They just want to pick out one thing from that.
Mm.
By all means, have that tomato.
Yeah.
Another person wants to eat one dish. By all means. Another person wants to try all 7 dishes. By all means. And then there's another kind of person that sees what we're doing and they're saying, wow, this is awesome. I want to learn how you cook these 7 dishes and how you serve them. And they want to, and that person wants to get involved in what happens in the kitchen and how the 7 dishes are made and how they're taken out and how they're served.
Mm.
That person is welcome too, and then we teach them how, and then they're part of the people that go out and serve the 7 dishes.
Mm.
So in this way, you know, to bring that analogy back and you know, say it as it relates to tea, it's about we're serving tea. And if what you get from us is that you have one bowl of tea and then you get up and go and your day is changed, wonderful. You have 7 bowls of tea. That happens. When we go out and serve roadside tea, it happens all the time. Some guy's like walking around long on a way to a meeting, and he's like, oh, interesting. And he sits down and has a bowl of tea, and he's still there 5 hours later.
Mm.
We even have people on a regular basis who sit down. They're like, this is interesting. They sit down. They have 2 bowls of tea, and they're like, you know, I have to go. And then they leave, and then they come back 30 minutes later. And they're like, I realize this is where I need to be.
Mm.
And that has happened to us on a regular basis. So, you know, it's about having something for everybody to you know, whether you want to just be served, right? We say this in the center all the time, that to the guests, that no matter what, if you're a guest in our center, you're of service. Because everyone here is practicing how to serve tea. And if we don't have anyone to serve, then we can't learn that,
yes.
Right? So whether you are here to learn how to serve tea or you're here to let us serve you, either way, you're of service.
Mm. Yes. I was thinking that about the homeless, that they're actually in service.
They are of service, yeah.
And all the people that travel far away to feed the poor, that it's actually those people are in service to those that need to experience that.
Absolutely. There's that one of my favorite parts of the Bible, and I can't quote it literally, but I can paraphrase it in my head because it's so important for me. But it's like Jesus says, you know, to those of you on the left, or to those of you on the right, I came to you as a stranger and you gave me shelter and you fed me, and to you heaven, and to those of you on the left, I came to you as a stranger and you turned me away and you didn't feed me, to you woe. And then those on the left say, when did we do this to you, Master?
Mm.
And he said, what you do to the lowest of my brothers is what you do to me.
Mm. Mm.
You know, so that's Jesus. That homeless person is Jesus. That's,
yeah.
You know, and he says this very specifically, so... I really like that part of the Bible. It's a very inspirational part for me.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite little chunks of wisdom from that.
A lot of truth
from those
in
teachings,
that.
Yeah.
I've met a lot of Buddhas in unforeseen situations, if you're open.
Yeah, and just to poke you,
yeah.
Suzanne, in those same terms, I'm going to give also another quote, which is from Gandhi. He who can't find God in the next person he meets need look no further.
Hmm. Beautiful.
Yes.
Touché. Well,
beautiful
said.
Quote. From Gandhi.
From Gandhi. Thank you. More on that soon. Okay, I can feel our friend, Tien. So what we're going to do is this wild tea is really nice.
Yeah.
We're going to sign out here, but we're going to pick up...
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Awesome.
on the art of not becoming distracted.
Yay.
So, thank you for this segment.
Most welcome.
All right.
Once again, I want to thank Wuda for joining us today, and next week we will have the second part of our conversation for all of you to enjoy. Please connect to the links below, and in the meantime, we're going to exit out with a little Alec Bridges. The song is Refuge, a beautiful song to accompany a beautiful bowl of tea. Until then, be well. This is she signing out with a deep bow, a soft gaze, and a namaste. Be simply.